But it is we who have the power in America, and we can change this once we figure it out. It's your job, you and the audience, to verify whether what I've said is true. And if so, to work together to change the rules so we all do better. Take Orwell to heart and struggle to see what is in front of your nose. Before I end, remember, I'm a medical doctor working in a medical care system where the work I do can cause harm. I still do it in the hopes of that I can help people with their immediate problems. But I don't think what I do in the emergency department has significant long-term benefits. So for those of you here who may have mental illness or be taking treatment, I'm not suggesting you change any of that, but consider what we can do together to prevent the United States leading the world in this invisible plague. So Daniel Defoe, writing in his journal of the plague year 1722, said, "It seems that the government had a true account of it, and several councils were held about ways to prevent its coming over, but all was kept very private. Hence it was that this rumor died off again, and people began to forget it as a thing we were very little concerned in, and that we hoped was not true." I think we'd all like to hope this isn't true so we can go back home to our Soma in our brave new world. But I think we must reach out to one another and make changes to have a healthier society. Let's work together on that. Thank you.
Stephen Bezruchka, MD, Public Health and ER Physician. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This next talk I've been saving on my hard drive for quite a while, waiting for a programming context in which to place it. The talk comes to us courtesy of Richard Ingram and the LA Sound Posse.
The following program was recorded on February 15, 2006 at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Barbara Brentz introduces Dr. Matt Ray on Leaving Las Vegas, Suicide and Self-Harm in the Neon Metropolis.
Tonight's speaker, Matt Ray, graduated from the University of California, Berkeley in 2000 with a PhD in Ethnic Studies and spent the following year as a postdoctoral fellow at the National Museum of American History at the Smithsonian Institute. There, he completed research for his book based on his dissertation, Not Quite White, White Trash and the Boundaries of Whiteness. Ray is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology here at UNLV, where he writes about culture and social problems and teaches courses in race and ethnic studies. And his current research in the topic of the talk tonight involves mapping the sociological dimensions of suicide in Las Vegas. I am pleased to introduce a good friend and excellent scholar, Dr. Matt Ray.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming. What you're about to hear is a 911 call made shortly after midnight, September 28, 2004. I'm going to play it in its entirety. While nothing in it is particularly shocking, neither is it for the faint of heart. So please listen closely.
Treasure Island, okay? The room number is 29064. please take care of her. Please get her back to her neighbor. I need you guys to go over there now and get her. You run my records, okay? You'll know I'm for real. I spent 4 years in the New Hampshire State Prison for rape and kidnapping, assault, and weapons charges.
And okay. A body. Is there a body over there?
There is a body on the floor there. Please take care of her, okay? Please get her back to her family, okay? And like I said, I'm sorry. It all was a f***ing accident, and it just spiraled out of control.
Are you in Las Vegas right now?
I am, my death will become very clear to you in a few minutes.
Can you tell me where you are so we can find you?
I can't, but I'm in a very public location right now. No one's in any danger, okay? So I thank you very much, and I thank you to go to Treasure Island.
Lauren, we're definitely going to go there and check. Okay. We want to make sure you're okay, and we don't want you to do anything.
Listen, I'm all done, and I don't want you talking to me about it. Just go up to the desk just so you know that I'm for real, okay? Last night, something happened to me at the bar. I had 4 drinks. I started hallucinating, okay? Security came up. I thought they were FBI. I was cowering in the corner. This is what happened. This happened between me and her, okay? So I don't know if there was something in my drink, but you could just talk to security and say that this happened last night, and you'll know you have the right guy, all right?
Okay.
So listen, I have to go now. In just a few minutes, you guys will get a call in. There's a note on, there's a note next to me with phone numbers to call. And I apologize. I don't want you to ever think that you couldn't do what you know that you did.
Lawrence, we'd like to talk to you first before you address anything.
I understand that, and listen, I'm an ex-con, all right? And I thought you'd be able to track this phone call soon enough. So, listen, I've got to go. I thank you, and trust me, there's absolutely nothing you can do. God bless you, and I thank you, and please, 29064, I know Lawrence Joyce from New Hampshire. She's the second guest.
So the room is in your name as well?
The room is in my name, that is correct.
Can you tell me where we can find you?
I can't, but then I'll tell you what, you're good. I have to go. Thank you.
You there?
A few hours after he hung up, the caller, Lawrence Joyce of Laconia, New Hampshire, jumped off the Hoover Dam, falling over 700 feet to his death, becoming one of dozens of people to have done so since the dam opened in 1935. Listening to the tape, I don't think one can help but be intrigued by it. Knowing how this story ends, we want to know how it began. Who was Mr. Joyce? And who was his poor victim, his girlfriend? What really happened in the hours and days leading up to this event? But for someone like me who is interested in suicide and suicidality, there is more than simple human interest to the story. This tape is actually a rare piece of data, and it's important to listen to what is being said and to how it's being said. We listen for any insights it may offer into the suicidal mind. And consider this, just how striking it is that he's so courteous and so deferential and respectful throughout. His tone stays that way, and there are lots of sirs, lots of thank yous. And this is revealing. For the people who are most likely to talk this way are those who have spent time in what sociologists call total institutions. Social institutions like prisons or psychiatric hospitals or even military training centers that attempt to control each and every action and interaction of their inhabitants. This way of speaking, with a kind of practiced formal deference to authority, turns out to be a valuable clue. At some point in the past, Mr. Joyce was institutionalized or incarcerated. He tells us that in the tape. Joyce repeatedly expresses thanks and gratitude to an extent that is sort of weirdly inappropriate. And while he shows some concern for the victim's family, it's almost as if he shows more concern for the 911 dispatcher. It's unclear if he actually feels any remorse. There's a coldness to his apologies. He feels a duty and an obligation to express thanks, and he performs that duty, but one senses that there's something maybe false and insincere about the performance. This is perhaps a second clue. This is a man who hides things even as he appears to be revealing himself. Why does he call? He's standing on the dam. His death is within reach. If he is determined, as he says he is, why not just jump? Well, maybe he's calling to give the impression of having it all under control. This appears to be important to him. Despite all the terrible things that have happened and the terrible things he's done, he wants to leave a good impression. Maybe the murder of his girlfriend was, as he repeatedly says, a fucking accident, but he believes it will never be seen that way, given his record. And if this really is his perception, and if this perception is accurate, we have every reason to believe it is, his actions actually appear quite logical. Faced with what he believes are his only two options, prison or suicide, he chooses the one that gives him the most control. That, anyway, is the story that he wants us to hear. That's the narrative that he weaves. At one point, he uses the phrase, a very public location, and we're again reminded that his public image is important, as are the details of his identity and his past. He wants to be remembered. He wants his story to be told. He wants his death to have some kind of public meaning and significance. And in this sense, he is perhaps more like most of us than he is different. Who really, in their heart of hearts, wants to be forgotten when they die? There's every reason to view the manner of suicide here as a communicative act, a message left not just in words, but symbolized through actions or time or place. So when it comes to choosing the place and manner of his death, one needs to ask what Joyce may have meant. Hoover Dam, like the Golden Gate Bridge, is freighted with heavy symbolism. Joyce did not choose a pedestrian bridge or a parking garage on the Strip. These are really too ordinary and too mundane. The dam, in contrast, is a significant American icon and an image of immense strength, power, and control. Dams express the power to hold back the raging and unpredictable energies of nature, and in doing so, they both protect us and give life. So did Joyce want us to believe that he somehow shared these qualities? Was the dam a symbol for what his life had been about, or about what he had tried to make of his life and failed? We'll never know. We'll also never know exactly what happened to precipitate his breakdown and the spasm of violence that followed. Whatever it was, the dam broke, and he simply could not contain the raging energies anymore. And he flew to his death like it was some kind of salvation. This, in the end, is what differentiates the suicidal from the non-suicidal. The non-suicidal sees suicide as a problem. The suicidal see it as a solution. I wanted to begin with this piece for several reasons, in part because I wanted to show how it's possible to mine little bits of data for lots of information. Indeed, suicide researchers have always relied on suicide notes as a primary source in their investigations. And in this sense, I'm just following the research tradition. This note just happens to have been left by a cell phone, and we'll probably be seeing more of that. There is a way, however, in which, by leading with this example, I can too easily mislead. The truth is, when it comes to suicide in Las Vegas, there is little that is typical about Joyce's case. We have a popular perception in Las Vegas that Las Vegas is a place people come to risk it all, and that when they fail, Las Vegas becomes a fitting place to end it all. This is what I call the Leaving Las Vegas scenario, after the novel and film of the same name. And while there's reason to believe that this scenario happens, we can all think of high-profile celebrity examples, and in fact, Joyce's story seems to fit rather nicely here. That is not what drives our high suicide rate. What the numbers actually show is that the vast majority of suicides in Las Vegas are not committed by tourists. Less than 10% annually of suicides are by out-of-towners. More than 90% are committed by Las Vegas residents. So Joyce's story is atypical of the pattern we normally see here on a day-to-day basis in our community. Oddly, however, it is stories like Joyce's that usually receive the most attention from local press. Joyce's suicide prompted four major news stories in the Las Vegas print media, more than any other story about suicide that year. Local media seemed to find the Leaving Las Vegas storyline to be very newsworthy. But while there are important exceptions, they make few attempts to cover the suicides of locals with any degree of depth or detail. Now, in their defense, there are perhaps good reasons not to do so, and we can discuss those later on. But the question remains, why would this be? Why all the attention to the out-of-towners? I'm sure it's typical in forum events like these for people like me to stand before people like you and share their research findings and attempt to impress you with a display of knowledge and understanding that will leave you feeling awed and impressed. And if that's the case, I may disappoint tonight. Anyone who has pondered suicide can tell you that it's ultimately a very frustrating and elusive subject. It's impossible even to catalog all that has been written about suicide. When it comes to suicide, I'd venture to say that we humans have probably spilt more ink than blood, and yet we're still perplexed. We still have questions about causes and meanings. So while there are many things we can say for certain about suicide in Las Vegas, for instance, we know that compared to the rest of the United States, we have a very high rate of suicide here and in Nevada generally. There are many, many more things we do not know. So while I'm going to share with you tonight what I've found out in the few short years I've been investigating this phenomenon, what I hope you'll remember most are the unanswered questions I'm going to pose. For example, given that the overwhelming majority of suicides here are by residents, is there something about Las Vegas or about living in Las Vegas that actually drives our residents toward suicide? Does Las Vegas make people suicidal? And if so, how could that be? What kind of mechanism can we imagine that might make such a thing possible? How can a place that is so loved by so many drive some of us to end it all? And how does a place or something about a place get into the body? How can Las Vegas get under your skin, into your mind, into your soul? Or is that the wrong question? Given that the overwhelming majority of suicides here are residents, is it possible that Las Vegas is somehow attracting people who are somehow more vulnerable or more prone to suicide? Is that what's driving the higher rate? That a higher percentage of newcomers to the city, and at any moment, more than 50% of the population here has been here for less than 5 years, a higher percentage are predisposed to suicide and self-harm, thus ensuring that even as our population grows, as it does nowhere else, our rate stays high. Now, this is a basic question, really a basic question. Is it something about the place, or is it something about the people drawn to the place? We have no idea what the answer is right now. However, there are ways to begin to explore the question. In sociological term, the question is posed, is it the community or is it the cohort? And we can test these very different hypotheses. I don't have an answer for you now, but my aim is to find one. So why does it matter? Why answer that question about community or cohort? Well, this is an important question in part because it relates to a more fundamental question, which is why study suicide at all? What do we hope to learn? The most immediate answer that comes to mind for most is that we should study suicide in order to better understand how to reduce or prevent it. And I agree with that, even as I sympathize with the objections from skeptics that we don't really have a lot of solid evidence that our prevention efforts have saved a lot of lives. However, there's a sense in which the urgency of that particular moral imperative, this sort of well-intentioned humanitarian mission to save people from self-harm, there's a sense in which that can obscure other important reasons for studying suicide. Let me give you an example. Emile Durkheim, the 19th century French sociologist and one of the founders of the discipline, made a famous study of suicide, but he didn't set out to save lives. Unlike what drives so much of the public interest in suicide today, he wasn't at all concerned with finding prevention techniques or with developing intervention tools and screening procedures or with postvention strategies to help those touched by suicide to cope and continue on. Durkheim was interested in something completely different. He wanted to show that suicide was actually a symptom of other things. Studying suicide for Durkheim was a way to see what is normally hidden from view. He saw the suicide rate mainly as an indicator of two things. One was the degree of social integration and social connectedness in society. And the second was the degree to which people are able to find social life meaningful and fulfilling. When you hear it put this way, you think, yes, of course, that makes perfect sense. People who are well integrated into their social worlds and networks, people who find life meaningful, these people rarely commit suicide. So if you have more people feeling that way, you'll have a lower suicide rate. But there's a way in which this view of suicide differs from the ones commonly held today. Today, we're predisposed to seeing suicide really as the act of desperate individuals, driven by their own demons or driven by their own free will to end their lives. We see it as an intensely personal, individual, even an existential choice, to be or not to be. It's, as the famous philosopher once said, the only truly important philosophical question. Suicide is widely seen today as the act of a sick person, a result of individual psychopathologies like severe depression. Durkheim thought this view of suicide as an individualistic act was bunk. He was not alone in his thinking. In fact, it was, among European intellectuals of the day, the consensus that suicide was more the result of social factors than it was of individual factors. And this consensus was the result of decades of statistical research in Europe and around the globe that showed that suicides were not randomly or evenly distributed across the social spectrum, as one would expect from a phenomenon that was driven by individual factors. Instead, these studies found that rates of suicide varied dramatically from one nation to the next, from one community to the next, and from one social group to the next, and that these rates, usually measured as suicides per 100,000, were remarkably consistent over time. In other words, suicide was a strongly patterned phenomenon. The rates and patterns were so consistent that they suggested the presence of some unknown law or laws governing them. Like the unseen laws of motion that governed moving bodies and produced regular and predictable outcomes and events, so too, Durkheim and others reasoned, there must be social laws dictating, for example, that day in and day out, year to year, the number of French citizens that killed themselves would hover around 5.6 per 100,000, and that within France, some groups had consistently higher rates and others consistently lower. All the empirical data showed these consistent variations. What was required was some way to uncover the laws that produced the variability. Durkheim set out to demonstrate that sociology was the best way to do this, and for half a century, his work, Der Suizid, first published in 1897, was considered unassailable proof of the superiority of the sociological approach to suicide. Durkheim, it appeared, had succeeded where all others had failed. Beginning in the 1950s, however, there were frequent attacks on Durkheim's methods, and these attacks succeeded in discrediting his approach, opening the door once again to psychological and medical perspectives that framed suicide as the act of individuals. And this is roughly where we are today, an era dominated by individualistic approaches to suicide, ones that look for answers inside the minds and bodies of people. Psychological approaches, biomedical approaches, and genetic approaches that dwell on the individual ultimately seek to know what has gone awry for the individual who suicides. Now, it's not that those perspectives aren't important. We absolutely need to have these sorts of disciplinary views. And I have, for instance, tried to show you how looking at a single case like Lawrence Joyce's can offer some useful insights and perspectives. And of course, there's mounting evidence that the biomedical perspective, in giving us new understandings of the neurochemical nature of depression and in providing new serotonin-enhancing drugs, is doing more to reduce the suicide rate than anything in human history. But given the way the rates vary across different social groups, individual-level explanations clearly don't explain everything. There's more going on here than just willful individuals acting out their personal psychic drama and traumas. The upshot is that the sociological approach to suicide tells us that we ought not study suicide in order to tell us what is wrong with suicidal people. Instead, we ought to study suicide to tell us what is wrong with us. A fuller analysis of suicide and suicidality will show us not only how some members of the community are failing to find meaning and contentment in their lives, it will also show us how we as communities are failing some of our members. That's essentially the setup. It's really been more explication than explanation, with me focusing on a lot that I don't know. And for those hungry for statistics, I now have a few to offer. I first want to point out, however, that suicide statistics are extraordinarily unreliable. Consider this data from the National Institutes of Medicine. Every year, about 1 million people commit suicide worldwide. Every year, some 30,000 Americans end their lives by suicide, and approximately 650,000 people receive emergency treatment after attempting suicide. Every 41 seconds, someone in the U.S. attempts suicide. Every 16.7 minutes, someone completes. And every day, over 85 people die by suicide. Suicide's the eighth leading cause of death in the U.S. and the third leading cause of death among American youth. Over the last 100 years, suicide in the U.S. has outnumbered homicide by at least 3 to 2. It's really shocking when you think about sort of the periodic national panics over the homicide rate and how little attention comparatively has been given to the phenomenon of suicide. For reasons that are not well understood, at this time, Nevada has always had high rates of suicide throughout its history. Ever since 1929, when the Silver State began registering vital statistics with the federal government, the state rate has been 2 to 3 times greater than the national rate. In the most recent decades, Nevada has had one of the highest overall suicide rates in the nation. With 19.1 suicides per 100,000 residents in the year 2000, Nevada's rate was almost twice the national average, which is about 10.7. Between 1993 and 2003, the overall rate in Nevada steadily declined from about 26 to about 19, yet remained about twice the national rate. In nearby states of California and Utah, which had rates of 8.8 and 13.8 respectively, these rates are significantly lower than the rates in Nevada. In 2003, Nevada had 2 suicides for every homicide, and more people died from suicides, about 423 people, than from motor vehicle accidents, about 351 people. And I think this is particularly significant considering the very high rate of DUI that we have here in Nevada. While statistically rare, suicide in Nevada now kills more than 400 people annually. Each year, thousands more attempt, with estimates that there are about 25 attempted suicides for every one that's completed. Thousands upon thousands of friends and family members have to live with the pain, the grief, and the guilt that follows suicide and non-fatal suicide attempts. Tens of thousands more are affected by non-lethal behavioral patterns of self-harm, what's known as suicidality or parasuicide, exhibited by themselves or by others. So the human costs of suicide and suicidality are staggering. Now, in response to this ongoing crisis, federal, state, and community agencies are beginning to direct more resources to the problem, even though the magnitude of the problem continues to outstrip any available resources. Earlier, I spoke about Durkheim's view that suicide rates can reveal social patterns and inequalities that might otherwise remain hidden from view. And this is thought to be a universal phenomenon, and it holds true in our region, where rates vary dramatically by gender, by age, by race and ethnicity, by chosen method, and by geographic location. So let me give you some examples. Suicides appear to cluster in specific geographic regions. There is a suicide belt in the Intermountain West, where 8 out of 10 states have rates that are twice the national average. Suicides differ by gender dramatically. Nevada males kill themselves about 4 times more often than do Nevada females, although females attempt suicide about 3 times more frequently than do males. Residents here age 45 and over have very high suicide rates. The rate is about 57.7. per 100,000, with those aged 75 and older showing the highest rates of all, 65.8 per 100,000. That's really almost 7 times the national average. Youth suicide has declined in our state since the early 1990s, but at 17.5 per 100,000, the rate remains at 1.5 times the national average. These are not the kind of categories in which you want your state to be above average. Among ethno-racial groups, whites and Native Americans have the highest suicide rates, 24.4 per 100,000 for whites. Hispanics and Asians have the lowest rates, 8.2 and 7.0 respectively. Rates for blacks residing in Nevada are on par with the national average. It's about 10.2 per 100,000. Residents of all races are more likely to kill themselves with guns than by any other method. Suicide by self-inflicted gunshot wound accounts for over 60% of all the suicides in Nevada, and I'll return to this point later. Suicide in rural counties, though very few in number, occur at a much higher rate than suicide in metropolitan counties. And bear in mind that statistical comparisons between metropolitan and rural county rates are often misleading, since rates are, as I said, based on this denominator of 100,000, And a single suicide in a rural county with a population of 2,000 people results in the exceedingly high rate and misleadingly high rate of 50 per 100,000. Now, in addition to the clustering in space I mentioned above and about which I'll say more in a moment, we also see clustering in time. Through the cooperation of the Clark County Coroner's Office, I have constructed one small data set which consists of 1,137 suicides between 1999 and 2002. And those data show that for those years, while suicides are fairly evenly distributed throughout the year, January and May were the deadliest months, and that more than 20% of the suicides occurred between 1 and 3 p.m. Now, there are some plausible explanations for why we see this clustering and why it may be important, this clustering in time, and we can perhaps discuss them later on. Even more intriguing than the temporal patterns that this data set contains are the spatial patterns that are hidden in these data. In the map I want to show you, a map prepared with the assistance of the City of Las Vegas Planning Department, you'll be able to see where what I'm calling suicide hotspots are depicted. And these three hotspots form a rather distinctive belt of suicide and suicidality. But there's also clustering in other parts of the map. And again, this is a small number of records from just 4 years. To get real analytical power, we need a much larger set. And it would be interesting, this mapping technology, we can actually track the movement of these hotspots over time. If we get enough, we can track it over decades. Now, the unanswered question, it's really the unasked question, why the spatial variation? And before we can answer that, there are other questions that we have to answer. For example, do these clusters actually map well onto existing neighborhoods? Can we account for these clusters just by looking at the populations in these neighborhoods? For example, is this neighborhood with a cluster home to a disproportionately high number of elderly white men living alone? These are the ones who have the highest suicide rate. We would expect to see higher rates in that neighborhood. So we can run a series of tests called spatial autocorrelation tests to find out. If that's not the case, and it appears not to be, then is it something about the neighborhoods themselves that is more productive of suicide? Again, this is the question I asked before. Is it the community or is it the cohort? We don't know, but there are a lot of theories and methods from the field of population health that we can use to find out. Let me actually just begin to close then by talking about some of the major themes of my research. This is the sort of big idea stuff that I've yet to work out fully, but that I want to share with you. The current paradigm in suicide research is not only individualistic, it seeks to identify, along with individual factors, group factors that may produce higher rates of suicide. Those factors that produce higher rates of suicide are known as risk factors. And they're also interested to find those factors that may produce lower rates, and these are known as protective factors. The idea is that with a more complete understanding of both risk and protective factors, we'll be in a better position to identify those who are at greatest risk and to make more effective interventions in the suicide process, thereby reducing the overall suicide rate. And researchers in biomedicine and psychology and sociology have identified dozens of actual and potential factors. I'm going to briefly highlight five factors which may help us understand our high suicide rates locally. And these are, first, social isolation and low social capital. Secondly, massive population growth. Number three, addictive behaviors. Number four, an ongoing mental health crisis. And five, guns and our frontier culture. And let me say now a bit more about each of these. Social isolation and low social capital, these are really variations on Durkheim's original ideas. Durkheim postulated that suicide rates would be highest in areas and among groups where individuals experience social isolation, that is, where they're not integrated into the social fabric, where the population is least connected through traditional bonds of social networks and social institutions. So areas experiencing rapid demographic change, areas that have weak social institutions, areas that are marked by low levels of civic engagement, low levels of integration, and this is today often called social capital, These are the areas that are expected to have higher suicide rates. Why? Because members of such communities lack social supports and networks, the protective factors that help us weather personal crises and find or rediscover meaning in their lives. Studies show that Las Vegas faces major challenges on all these fronts. Our city has undergone a demographic explosion. It has relatively weak social institutions, particularly its governance, and it scores very low on several different social capital indicators. So this cluster of problems may actually best explain not only our high overall suicide rate, but also the social and geographical variation in suicidal behavior, as the impacts of these various problems vary in intensity from one group to the next and from one neighborhood to the next. Population growth and demographic change, social isolation can result from rapid population growth as well as reflect the characteristics of the specific groups of people who are moving into the area. Such population changes can affect the suicide rate. For instance, a large number of the retirees and seniors moving to Nevada may be particularly vulnerable to isolation and suicide, especially when they lose a spouse or a close friend, when they face an unexpected financial crisis, or struggle with chronic or terminal health problems. The result can be an upward pressure on the overall suicide rate. Conversely, the in-migration, the influx of ethno-racial groups with historically low suicide rates, such as Latinos and Asians, some groups of Asians, may exert a downward pressure on the overall rate. Indeed, the fact that our suicide rate remains relatively high despite sharply rising numbers of Latino residents is an unusual fact and is in need of explanation. Addictions and addictive behavior. There's empirical evidence linking suicide to alcohol and substance use disorders, known as AUDs and SUDs, alcohol substance use disorders. For instance, the National Institutes of Health estimates that AUDs and SUDs affect up to 90% of all people who die by suicide nationwide. And my own data set shows that between 1999 and 2002, over 94% of those who killed themselves, over 94% of those who killed themselves in Clark County tested positive for drugs and or alcohol at the time of death. Now, there are real limits to the tox screen that they do at the coroner's office. It doesn't tell us how intoxicated people are, whether they even have a long history of AUDs or SUDs, but it does strongly suggest that at least here, suicide is not the act of a sober mind. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that other addictions, in addition to AUDs and SUDs, may play a significant role in driving up our suicide rates. For example, addictions related to gambling, to cigarettes, and to sex are hard to control and treat in an environment that offers pretty much unlimited 24-hour access to all three. Even though AUDs and SUDs afflict many residents, affordable, effective treatment programs are scarce. And compounding this problem is the fact that while many of these behaviors are stigmatized in other parts of the country, gambling, cigarette smoking, and sex, here they form a really prominent part of the social and cultural landscape. And in fact, they function as an important part of our economic engine. But given this unique situation, people with addictions may be more inclined to indulge them in our state than anywhere else. Now, apart from AUDs and SUDs, the connections between addictions and suicide are not well understood. Yet we know that such addictions can, and often do, create severe financial strains, precipitate major psychological depression and other mental health problems, erode social and familial support, increase the sense of social and psychic isolation, and cause irreversible physical health problems. And all of these conditions increase suicide risk for both individuals and affected groups. The mental health crisis in Nevada. According to the American Medical Association, 95% of people who complete suicide have a diagnosable psychiatric illness at the time of death. At the same time, 80% of people consider psychiatric illnesses to be a character flaw and blame life emergencies like divorce and bankruptcy rather than depression for the decision to end life. Understanding that depression is the leading cause of suicide, that mental health issues are behind more than 90% of lethal suicidal acts, is critically important for suicide prevention. But our mental health crisis may be a major contributing factor in our high suicide rates. The historically underdeveloped mental health infrastructure in both rural and metropolitan areas throughout the state is probably playing a significant role. And here are just two statistics to consider on this point. With 42% of our population reporting poor mental health in the past 30 days, Nevada has the highest rate of mental illness among the 50 states. At the same time, 2005 per capita spending on mental health ranks Nevada 38th out of 50. The absence of adequate mental health facilities and professionals to staff them, combined with residents' self-reported mental health problem, reveals a major problem. Even those seeking professional help for their psychological distress may find that they do not receive the services and treatment they need in order to survive. We are nowhere near meeting the mental health needs of our citizens. Gun ownership, and what I want to call a frontier culture. Guns are the most lethal means available to attempt suicide, far more effective than overdoses, strangulation, or cutting. Given the high rate of gun ownership throughout Nevada and the Intermountain West, the whole suicide belt, it's logical to suspect a direct link between increased access to lethal means, i.e. increased access to guns, and the high regional suicide rate. Skeptics object that international data show that higher levels of gun ownership do not always correlate with higher levels of suicide. And that's true. For example, personal gun ownership is more prevalent in Switzerland than in our country, but our suicide rates are higher here in the United States. The crucial difference is that Switzerland has incredibly strict gun control laws, which make gun ownership prevalent, but which make gun usage rare. As I understand it, in Switzerland, they actually control the bullets. So, like many, I see easy access to guns as a major factor. How major, I can't say, but it's a hypothesis that we certainly need to test. This is a difficult one because feelings about guns run strong in both directions. And there are very strong cultural factors at work, forces that affect and shape suicidal behavior here and throughout the region. It's almost a red state, blue state kind of thing, and in many ways it's a sort of rural versus urban kind of thing. But stated broadly, the more general idea about the frontier culture is that the cumulative effects of Nevada's history as a mining and ranching frontier may play a decisive role here. Frontier residents place a premium on self-reliance, fostering a Wild West culture that produces a kind of go-it-alone libertarian mentality. In such a culture, there can be widely shared attitudes that have implications for social health. For instance, help-seeking behaviors tend to be stigmatized, discouraging those who need assistance from seeking or accepting it. Also, violence may be more valued as a legitimate response to difficulties and to frustrations. Such historical and cultural legacies may lead some residents, above all long-term residents, and perhaps above all older white men, to the conclusion that suicide is not just an acceptable, but also an especially honorable way to deal with personal troubles and disappointments. Understanding this frontier mentality may help explain why rural areas have higher suicide rates than metropolitan areas, and why white men and Native American men have the highest rates of all. Now, the list of risk factors I've given you here is far from exhaustive. These and others need to be further studied. We need to study such suicide-fostering causes before we can make definitive claims about which factors are most important and why. By way of conclusion, I want to return to Lawrence Joyce. What kind of person was he? Was he a risk-taker? Impulsive, but decisive? Totally committed to his plan of action, even if others were doubtful of the outcome? Do we hear in his voice, his last message, a certain conception of manhood, one that projects firmness and resolve, control and competence, strength and responsibility? Do we see a man who is not afraid of violence, who in fact believes violence can be a way to solve problems, who believes perhaps that violence can even be a way to transform oneself spiritually? Do we hear a man who likes to keep secrets, who practices deception? I don't know for sure, but here's that other question. Does Las Vegas attract people like Mr. Joyce, not just as tourists, but as residents? This city, this neon metropolis, is built on risk and the pursuit of risk. It proclaims loudly to the world that life is a gamble and that no place understands that or accepts that more than we do here. We welcome people to come here and take a risk. We welcome people and tell them that their secrets are safe with us. It's part of how we now brand ourselves to the world. We can easily see the positive consequences of that message. We can count the $12 billion in gaming revenue last year. We can see the low unemployment rate. We can watch the joys of growth combined with relative prosperity. However, do we ever stop to think about the negative consequences? And are we in any way prepared to deal with those negative consequences? How do we confront our collective indifference to all the dead bodies that are piling up around us? Again, I don't know the answer, and the truth is the question's not mine to answer. It's ours to answer. It's yours and mine. Maybe I can throw this back up and show you the more graphically the clustering I'm talking about. Here we have a cluster at Fremont Street and Las Vegas Boulevard, which extends down Boulder Highway just a bit. And then we have a light clustering in between. And these three areas are really kind of linked. They actually all are near Maryland Parkway. And you see that you also get some clustering out here on Boulder Highway. Over here in Summerlin, down here at Jones and Trop, a few up here towards Sunrise Manor, and so forth and so on. I know you are all furiously looking for your neighborhood and wondering whether or not you are now at risk because of where you live. But let me take your questions. The comment is that one common thing about these areas is that the housing stock is single room onlys, it's weekly apartments, it's people who are transient. And this speaks directly to the issue of social isolation and social capital. So we see in these neighborhoods what, for lack of a better word, we can just refer to as lonely people.
There's a lot of homeless in that area.
Especially here, yes?
Fremont and all the way down Maryland Park.
Uh-huh. Homeless people are not actually recorded on this map, but you're right. I'm not taking anything away from you say, but these dots that you see here are not the locations of suicides. These are the addresses of the residents who commit suicide. I have other maps which map the locations of suicides, and the maps differ. There are hotspots. There's a little cluster actually out at Red Rock. So you get very different results when you map by location of suicide versus residents. Yes? That's a really important question. Do the percentages include drug overdoses? The statistics I've given you are statistics that are provided by the coroner's office. The coroner makes determinations as to the manner and cause of death. If they have a case of accidental overdose without a clear indication of suicidality, that is, a note, the direct testimony of a friend or family member who will definitively say that it's a suicide, it is not ruled a suicide. It's ruled an accidental death. And this is one of the tricky things about suicide statistics, is that as sort of alarming as the statistics are, we know that it's an undercount because we're not capturing a lot of deaths that on closer investigation would prove to be in fact suicides. This is also the case with single vehicle motor accidents. What happens when someone drives into a freeway abutment at 90 miles per hour and there's no skid marks? Well, he fell asleep at the wheel, did he? Again, in the absence of a very high degree of certainty, the coroner's office will not say that it's a suicide. And they do that for obvious reasons. They can't be seen as inflating the rate or making a determination of death based on a guess. So it's a really important question. What we see is a very strong association with suicide as an urban phenomenon. Even though the rates are higher in the rural areas, it's strongly associated with urbanism and urbanity rather than rurality, which is the opposite of what the crude statistics would lead us to believe. So it's very complicated for the reasons that she spoke of and the question you're asking about. It's very complicated to use suicide statistics in any reliable way and for especially a layperson to make sense of any of it. Interestingly, though, Lawrence Joyce, before he jumped, told the officers on Hoover Dam that he had a gun. And he tried at least twice to draw fire to himself. So it was a clear case that even though he said he was going to jump, he was going to end his life, he couldn't do it. He wanted the authorities to do it to him. And it was only when they wouldn't take that bait and wouldn't do that that he jumped. The question is, does every suicide person leave a note? Most don't, and that's why I said at the beginning that the value for me in the 911 tape is in fact that it's a relatively rare piece of data for us to look at. Two points there. One is that there's a difference between anonymity and social isolation. and that anonymity may be a greater factor than social isolation. And the second was the question, has everyone thought of suicide at some point? Are people feeling in a truthful mood? Should I take a straw poll? Sometimes you wonder when you begin to study suicide, when you think of all of the problems that people face in life, you sometimes wonder why more people don't. Why isn't our rate higher? Life is not always easy. And given the availability of ways to end it, and given the decreasing stigma around it, the loss of kind of the religious protection, which would prevent a lot of people from acting on those impulses, why don't we see more of it? Has anyone not been depressed to the point where they've thought, this is just it for me, I don't know how to go on? And I face that question a lot in speaking with my interviewees and in reviewing these files. It's an ever-present question. Bruce, the Native American rate is, again, one of those very tricky statistical things because there are just so few numbers. So the rate can be spiked by two suicides, and it's somewhat misleading. The most sort of striking spike in the demographic within the Native American population is among Native American youth. And so there's a special concern because, like most people, most people feel that teen suicide is particularly tragic and particularly preventable. And so there's a lot of attention to it, and rightly so. Sir? Yeah, that's part of what I'm suggesting is I think we are seeing a kind of destigmatizing of suicide and, in some cases, a real glorification of suicide. And, I feel two ways about that. One is that one of the real difficulties of suicide is that the survivors of suicide feel about that death in ways that people who lose family members or loved ones to natural causes or to disease just don't feel. There's always a sense of guilt, right? That you should have seen it coming, you could have done something to prevent it. So as the stigma of suicide goes down, the survival rates of the survivors may go up because they don't have to live not only with the burden of guilt, but with the stigma that comes, right, with it. But as you remove that stigma, does the rate go up? I don't know how to answer that question. I only know how to pose it. In the back. Yes, that's a good question. That's an important point. We have a very high out-of-towner rate. We have a very high tourist rate, suicide. It may be the highest, although I have not been able to get accurate numbers for Atlantic City, which some have suggested to me is another place where they see similar high rates among tourists. Let me just expand on your question to point out that one of the really difficult challenges with doing this research is that while I say that 90% of the, and more than 90% of the suicides are by residents, I don't know the term of their residency. I don't know how long they've been here. What I know and what the coroner's office can tell me is that they're holding a Nevada driver's license. So that means they could have been here 6 weeks, or they could have been here 6 months, or they could have been here 60 years. I can't tell you that. I do know that they're Nevada residents at the time of their death. But whether they're newcomers, and as I pointed out before, at any given moment, 50% of Las Vegas residents can be considered newcomers because they've been here less than 5 years. But this question of how long people are here is a particularly devilish one. Yes?
About the 95% of people that had mental illness at the time, how is that determined?
It's an estimate, and I have to tell you that I don't know how the National Institutes of Health arrived at it. It's a widely circulated statistic, and I can give you the citation. I cannot tell you how they arrived at it. So I'm skeptical about it as well. It's in the interest of the National Institutes of Mental Health in particular to take that approach. Yeah.
That's why I'm having trouble with all these numbers.
We all have trouble with the numbers, and this. I hope that you don't think that this presentation was about numbers, because I find that suicide statistics are very, very tricky. And it's very easy to look at suicide statistics and try to infer from them theories, which then will fit. But it's more important, or it's as important, I think, to ask, how do we arrive at these numbers in the first place? What do they mean? Is everyone using the same yardstick? And I can tell you right now, everyone's not. There are, for instance, major differences between the way coroner's offices and medical examiner's offices adjudicate suicide. And there are real differences, and studies have been shown that demonstrate that medical examiner systems are more reliable and offer more reliable counts. So when you compare across regions, across states, even across jurisdictions, you don't even know that these numbers mean the same things.
Who else?
Yes. The question is essentially, do gray skies influence the suicide rate? And there's evidence that it does, although not in the way that you would think. What we see in the Northern Hemisphere is that the deadliest month for suicides is May. And that's true in Las Vegas as well. Why would it be May? Well, it's the case that a significant percentage of the population, maybe as much as 10 or 12%, suffers from what's known as SAD, seasonal affect disorder. When you are deprived of sunlight, sort of evolutionary processes of hibernation take over, and your metabolism is suppressed, your emotional state is suppressed, and you become depressed. During that winter, most people are actually too depressed to do anything about it. But when the days get longer in spring, when May comes, when they get more energy, the plans are made, the suicide rate spikes. That's sort of the standard explanation for why we see this. And the real test is whether the opposite pattern obtains in the Southern Hemisphere. And I have not yet seen any studies which have tested that. But people in the Southern Hemisphere don't suffer from seasonal affect disorder as much as people in the Northern Hemisphere do. Yes?
There seems to be kind of a shift towards the romantic that is socially acceptable in our culture versus the factual and prevention mentality. How do you think that compares with the cultures of other countries that don't have as high or that do have high suicide rates?
That's a really good question, and I don't know the answer because, you know, what I know is American pop culture, and it's certainly the case that European nations have struggled with this. There's a long and famous tradition of the most famous French intellectuals, rock star intellectuals, really, committing suicide, and that's seen as noble, honorable, a fitting conclusion if cutting life short. This is a way in which it's glorified and held up as exemplary. That's not the case here. When academics die by suicide, my suspicion is that there's a lot of students out there who cheer. But it's not the case in Europe. It's not the case in other places. But we do see in pop culture, in American pop culture, a long history of a kind of romanticization of suicide and suicidality, going back to like Rebel Without a Cause, and going back even further than that. So it's a strong part of our mythos. And it's what I meant to point to when I talked about the cultural dimensions of suicidality.
Are you looking for the large volume, like the ones that do it the most?
I'm really looking for the whole spectrum. And, you know, while my interest might be in trying to account for the groups that are at greatest risk and why they're at greatest risk, I don't believe I can understand that until I also understand what's protecting the groups that are at the lowest risk. Okay, so for instance, the group with the lowest rate of suicide in the nation and the group with the lowest rate of suicide in Las Vegas are African-American women. African-American women do not kill themselves. They do so in such small numbers that the rate is about 1.5 to 2%. I'm sorry, 1.2 to 2 per 100,000. We're talking several times less than the rate we see for white males, which in some age groups is up at 40 to 50 per 100,000. How do you explain that racial and gender disparity? You certainly can't explain it just by talking to white men. You certainly can't explain it just by talking to African-American women. You need to talk to both groups and find out what's going on in those communities. What are the protective factors? Are they cultural? How is it that some are placed at risk, others are placed in out of harm's way?
Matt Ray, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Nevada, speaking on Las Vegas in Las Vegas, 2006. He's presently Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health and Society Scholar at the Department of Society, Human Development, and Health at the Harvard University School of Public Health. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.